I try to mimic some healthy, good-natured Vermont ski school instructor who might respond to this freakish, blood-sucking life force with a hearty, "Good morning," and a total nod of full-fledged agreement at what a beautiful day it is. I only manage, in spite of my best efforts, a quiet, "Uh-huh," and a deadly, "Very beautiful." Holding Marco defensively in front of me, I try to head directly for the coffee pot, but she bends at the waist and proffers both of her cheeks for me to kiss. It's an excruciating habit she's had ever since we all of her kids, achieved parent-child separation more than 30 years ago. Instead of honoring our oogie meter, which would buzz and wail and flash wildly when she sought these kisses, she bulldozed right over it and insisted on receiving compulsory, desultory kisses on both cheeks from children who felt they needed a silkwood shower after the whole transaction. When my dead brother Todd, who became a voracious, virile Wall Streeter, a vice president at Goldman Sachs by the time he was 28 or something unheard of, and where he was, in a certain way, running the entire world, he still, even at 40 years old on his annual obligatory visit, would have to kiss the cheeks of our mother, who would bend at the waist and mewl like a kitten, tapping her fleshy finger against her fleshy cheek. Todd, who was accustomed to holding two phones up to his two ears at the same time and altering the fates by spitting no more than four staccato words through his unsmiling lips alternately into both of them, really used to grimace through that one. I was hoping, in vain, that glorious fall foliage morning, standing in the mere 9 feet of hallway between the bedroom and the bathroom with my son and my husband and my mother, that the past 20 years of cutting her off might have sent a certain signal to her. I was hoping she would observe that I had become something of a full-fledged, self-possessed adult with rights and wishes regarding her affections, that I had become something other than her issue, over whom she seemed to believe she had total proprietary access to bodily privileges. But with Todd dead, I realized, as she nuzzled up to me and made me kiss her on both cheeks while she made her little kitten noises, she had some capital, an unexpected windfall, with which to work. She was the bereft mother of a recently dead son. It was just the license she needed to be maudlin and to leverage greater physical closeness than she had inspired. I was not strong enough or gracious enough to allow her this. She had, in fact, just lost a child. But somehow that did not, as it might in a made-for-TV movie, suddenly sew up the 20-year gap. Instead, I just felt physically trespassed upon, snared in her sticky web at 8 o'clock in the morning with a hairy spider bestowing and demanding indiscriminate wet affection. But now, as I'm trying to get away from her and to endure the compulsory cheek kissing, I notice her shoes, sensible sand-colored crepe-soled shoes from Payless, made in China. And she's wearing oatmeal-colored socks on which the elastic has worn out, which she is holding up at each knee with rubber bands. I'm so taken aback, I point at them. Mistaking me, she proudly sticks out her leg to model the shoe with an insouciant little twist of her still outrageously elegant dancer's ankle, which I recall my entire life seeing in a good Dior heel. "Pas mal, eh?" she boasts about this ugly, sensible number that is one step up from a Velcro closing sneaker. $12, she continues, delighted, vainglorious, the cat who ate the canary. I observe, with not a little discomfort, that this is just the kind of thing I also do. When one of the 20-year-old waiter girls at work admires my jacket, skirt, or shoes, I say, "Hey, $20 at the Salvation Army in Buffalo." When you have some style and taste, but you don't have the cash, you brag about your finds from the thrift store. You sit in your chair with great satisfaction when you pull off a delicious dinner for 10 people for only $40, the same way my mother fed a family of 7 on tails and carcasses and marrow bones. But seeing her now and how uncannily similar we are, I fear that it won't be long before I, too, am so obsessed with thrift that I have manifested my own poverty and am holding my socks up with rubber bands, living alone in the middle of nowhere, estranged in varying degrees from all of my children who would rather not kiss me, given their druthers. How far down the path am I already if I make Prune's dishwashers nest the bowls properly after they are washed, and if I stop a cook from throwing away the onion tops because these are perfectly good, and someone had to grow it, pick it, wash it, and then get it here, and that someone wasn't you, and now you're just going to throw half of it away? I ask, incredulous, peeved. like a freaking lunatic who may as well wear two pairs of glasses at the same time, and who, I fear, will be working that same fashion statement before long. How can it be, after all this concentrated effort and separation, how can it be that I still resemble, so very closely, my own detestable mother? But what is there to detest? I am scrutinizing her, now 70-something years old, alone on her hill. What is so detestable? She has splurged and generously bought half and half for our morning coffee. She roasted two birds for dinner when one would have stretched. She fetches and splits and stacks the wood by herself. If a bat flies in, she chases it out. She is holding her socks up with rubber bands, but she has her living will, her healthcare proxy, and her estate and final years totally taken care of in a way that will never saddle her children with awkward and difficult decisions. And now, in the daylight, we go through the wines that Michele packed and the hard-to-find Asian ingredients that I packed, and we spend the morning talking, neutrally, about food and wine. It is unclear if either of us is going to mention the past 20 years. I am prepared to skip it because that's not why I've come. She seems just as inclined. So we discuss the best way to store and cook Vietnamese rice stick. I see pinned above her little desk a cartoon torn from the New Yorker, in which a piece of rigatoni pasta answers the phone and exclaims, "Fusili, you crazy bastard, how the hell have you been?" And she and I laugh solidly 3 minutes over that one. Even Michele joins in. She speaks a little Italian that she has learned over the years to Michele, but he answers in English, so mostly she goes on in an English heavily peppered with French. My mom grew up in a French-speaking home and spoke French to her parents until the days they died. Michele tries to answer her in the little French he knows, but in an Italian accent so thick, he is just impossible to understand. I recognize this simply as the need that two people in a room who speak more than one language always seem to have. They need to demonstrate their ability to speak more than one language. But somehow it makes me want to inch back a little further toward the deepest wall of my mental shed while this little patch of rain falls. I am drawn to Marco's simplicity. He just needs to eat and sleep. "Well, Pruny, how do you use this jar of Asian soup paste?" She is squinting at it, perplexed. It seems odd to be showing my mother a jar of tom yum paste and explaining its potential in soup and noodle dishes when she is the woman who taught me everything I know, pretty much, about eating, cooking, and cleaning. But she seems to be doing what everybody does when they age, becoming incrementally less and less competent. I expect this with her in terms of technology. The stunning rigmarole around an answering machine and cordless phone in the 1980s made it exceptionally clear that she was not going to join us in the computer age. But I am kind of taken aback by this confusion with the food. And now it's me who's staring at her sternly, like she's an imbecile, much as she looked at me when I was 10, trying to understand what she was saying about slicing a corned beef across the grain. I remember being baffled by what the grain of a hunk of meat meant, but she was relentless in her expectation and unyielding in an explanation, and so I figured it out in spite of her menacing gaze. And I began slicing clean, thin planks of corned beef by sawing back and forth across the grain and noticing how it stopped shredding now that I had turned the meat. But I just cannot believe she doesn't know how to stir a little paste into chicken stock or coconut milk or both. Is it possible that I now know more than she does about food and cooking? Have I surpassed her? I consider for a moment that it's the foreign part of the jar that defies her, but this is the most sophisticated, snobbish woman in the world. Traveled, exposed, she regularly read the New York Times and the New Yorker, listened exclusively to classical music in our house, danced in the corps of the New York City Ballet, saw Balanchine in the corridors, blew past the overweight tourists in our town as they trudged along the cobblestones in their white sneakers enjoying the quaint historical markers and the gas lanterns while licking ice cream cones, and she'd snarl out the window of her antique Benz, "Gros cochon!" She gave us all champagne at Christmas and taught us to flip the Savoyard ladyfinger biscuits from the edge of the table up high into the air and have them land, with a festive splash, in the flute. This same woman unable to navigate a jar of Vietnamese soup paste? Pas possible. At last, the afternoon has passed and it has gotten dark. Michele opens an Aglianico, a real beauty, but my mom declines. She is accustomed to a little cocktail, she says, that she really prefers to anything else anymore. I watch as she pours some blackberry schnapps, white jug wine, and a tablespoon of brandy into a jelly jar over ice cubes. I am stunned. My mother is drinking some sort of shitty wine cooler, torpedo juice. My snobbish superior mother, the woman who taught me everything I know, delectable and odious alike, has been shed, and here before me is a new woman, a woman that anyone meeting for the first time would find perfectly lovely. I am suddenly wondering what I've been so afraid of and what I've so diligently kept my distance from these past 20 years. A quiet internal frenzy starts, in which I try to recall and to catalog all of the reasons I might have ended my relationship with this perfectly nice woman who has roasted chickens, built a fire, and who is now casually fixing herself a disgusting wine cooler that would have been way beneath her when I last knew her. To be clear, all of our differentness when we were growing up was not merrily enjoyed in a live and let live, à chacun son goût kind of benevolence. Something in our household was being arduously protected. Our shit was fiercely defended and prioritized. Everybody around us went to the Jersey Shore for vacation, but my mother would never. All of our school friends lived in plain houses with a swing set in the backyard, but we lived in the burnt-out ruins of a 19th-century silk mill with pigeons and bats and said unkind things about the cookie-cutter developments called Sunset Drive and Village 2. Most people ate Mrs. Paul's frozen fish sticks and Kraft macaroni and cheese and Oscar Mayer bologna, but we ate coq au vin, sesame breadsticks, and le puy lentils for less money than the store-bought stuff. Other people had rec rooms and television, but we were forced to entertain ourselves outdoors, even in the rain, from waking to bedtime. Other people threw all of their garbage into one big bin, but we composted, recycled, and separated and drove it all to the center. Other kids got Partridge Family lunchboxes with snack pack puddings, but we got ratatouille sandwiches on homemade bread in oily brown paper lunch bags. And we were taught by her to see ourselves as infinitely better for our dedication to high culture. I've been trying for 20 years to rid myself of this Gallic snobism. When I see my now 70-something-year-old mom pour herself a tumbler of wine cooler, the oppressive, heavy, wet burden of snow slides off the roof of my soul in one giant thawing chunk, and suddenly I feel clear, light, and permissive. Marco is asleep in the basket, but I risk waking him and get down and give him a long, soft kiss on the head. This fucking bitch, I think, but without any of the electric adrenaline I felt when I first thought this sentiment 30 years earlier. This is a bait and switch. I quietly understand. I have developed deep, rigid grooves and stone-like calluses around these perfectionisms, elitisms, excellences, and impeccablenesses, these high standards of nothingness to which we were held, that she no longer even cares about or holds herself to. In the intervening years since I last knew this woman, she has softened and changed. Casually, idly, by happenstance, I discover that my mother now drinks blackberry schnapps mixed with jug wine and isn't even embarrassed or apologetic, and suddenly I ache with a retrospective shame. I send one blanket megaton apology out into the universe, smoothing my lips against Marco's forehead. I feel like I could have been so much kinder to so many people if I had just known this earlier about her. When Michele and Marco and I leave the following morning, there's thankfully no mention of the future. I don't promise to return, and she doesn't ask me to. She holds my hand and tugs me outside behind her house and weepily shows me the tree she has planted for Todd, and I try to take my hand back because I still feel uncomfortable when she touches me. I hold Marco so close to my chest I can feel him swallow and breathe as I kiss my mother goodbye on both cheeks. Chapter 15. Every time I get pregnant, at first, it's just fun news for the staff of my restaurant to gossip about. There is no inkling of the reality attached to the announcement, "Hey guys, I'm pregnant." And then as I grow and waddle, I'm just an amusement for the crew, an excuse for a betting pool, gender and birth date, and a great entertainment as I try to bend over to pick some vegetable peel off the floor when I can't even touch my own toes. But when I started to really get close to the reality of my first son, Marco, and out to here with a belly, my sous chef at the time, Matt, a 37-year-old former Marine, fell apart in my arms with an anxiety attack so severe I had to rush him to the VA hospital. Hustling him to the ER entrance on 23rd Street as best as I was able in my condition, huge and breathless, we soon, fortunately, were reassured that his EKG was absolutely normal and his psychosomatic heart attack was all in his head. I left him on the hospital gurney to rest and recover in the capable hands of the VA nurses and walked back to work. It is true that he would soon be under a lot of pressure to keep the restaurant in order while I was away having my baby and nursing for the first few weeks. And it is also true that his much-respected and loved mother had just died. Equally true is that within days of his mother's passing, my own brother Todd died suddenly of a rare and massive stroke, and it is true as well that I was just 10 days away from giving birth for my first time. Either way, in the end, it was me who worked the egg station at brunch that weekend. When I found myself down on all fours after that pummeling brunch service, cleaning pancake batter off the reach-in fridge with a green scrubby while my belly grazed the mats, and my staff seemed calm and assured that the ship still had a captain, I wondered, uneasily, about who I'd become. At the time, I was proud of my capableness, my strength, my dry-eyed and clinical receipt of the news of Todd, not to mention my handily earned boasting rights over Matt, which I later flaunted, kind of behind his back, with a studied nonchalance. Whatever, Matt went down, fake heart attack. But I worked eggs at 39 weeks pregnant. I shrugged, as if it were nothing to speak of. I sounded like one of those defensive, eternal line cooks with nowhere to ever go from there, who still pulls back his sleeves to proudly show off his burns, when all of us who have deepened our focus and pushed through to greater accomplishments know that a little experience and a finessed game could keep your arms relatively free of burns. In the week preceding the birth of my second child, Leone, 21 months later, a line cook responsible for 5 shifts a week quit unexpectedly. Connor, a kind of bland and amiable dude, came to the office and said, listen, I've been made an offer I can't refuse. I had been fantasizing about a modest and crazily spontaneous 3-day getaway to a beach place just to get a tiny break before the onslaught of a new infant and the constant suckling that makes me feel cannibalized, and the unhinging I experience from sleep deprivation when I never hit REM sleep for the better part of a year. In my mind, if I could book it online and find a maternity bathing suit fast enough, I would ignore the doctor's no air travel rule and score a lightning breakaway to one of those all-inclusive resorts in Turks and Caicos with a swim-up bar where you don't need to carry any money. I knew it was a fantasy, but still, in it, my little Marco could have breakfast with Big Bird and make cookies in the afternoon with Cookie Monster, while Mama spent the afternoon at the maternal massage spa, the sun-soaked beach, and the virgin rum drink lounge. But with Connor standing in my basement office giving notice on this cold and rainy April afternoon, I knew, realistically, where my next 3 days would be spent. I said, looking up from the schedule I was just finishing, which outlined the next 6 weeks and which had Connor featured in at 5 shifts a week, as we had just confirmed and talked about at length merely days before. Tell me more. Well, he sighed, it's like hardly any hours and it's like triple the pay. This is exactly as much as I need to hear. He is dead to me. There are more words, about 15 minutes worth, but I hear nothing. I loathe the way he offers this line of reasoning. Triple the pay and hardly any work. To me who has thrived her whole life on triple the work for hardly any pay, obliviously expecting it to be the salient point that cements my opinion of him as a decent guy who, as if fatally, has an opportunity that cannot be resisted. How can I turn that down? He asks, holding out his hands, palms up. You know? You know is that horrible interrogative at the end of a sentence that demands your complicity in the story. But I'm staring at the guy, days away from my due date, thinking, well, of course you can turn it down, bonehead. You say, I'm sorry, I am not available for that job at this time as I just made a commitment to my employer for another 6 months. Would you please consider me again in 6 months' time? But I say nothing. I listen to his earnest and apologetic speech, which he has rehearsed on the subway, and feel his hot air blow over me as if it were the Caribbean breeze I am being deprived of. Without even flinching, I say, Okay, so can you give me 2 weeks? Is this a standard 2 weeks? He looks down at his hands. Well, I wanted to tell you last Monday, but you seem so busy, so it's almost 2 weeks, but not totally. My last day will be not this, but the coming Sunday. I look back at the calendar. That leaves me 8 days to have a baby and fill Connor's shifts. While I can do kind of extraordinary things with my own body under some pretty intense pressure, even I can't cover a line cook from a hospital bed with 4 stitches freshly sewn into my perineum. Okay, Connor, Sunday then. Thanks. I can generally punt pretty painlessly with one man down, but in this case, it was supposed to be me who was the one man down. Connor put us at 2 down. That made me nervous. The weekend passed, and on Sunday night, I discussed this with my sous chef, Alexis. She said about Connor, "Ugh, good riddance to that tool," practically spitting on my clogs. Okay, I agree with you philosophically, but pragmatically, that will mean 7 days straight for you and 6 shifts in a row for one of the others, at least until I hear back from some of the calls I placed. Whatever, she said. We can handle it. I am calmed somewhat by her reassurance that she can handle a 7-day week and wrangling the rest of the cooks into a 6-day week and the lag until we find a replacement quickly. These things are harder in a small restaurant where we can't carry any excess payroll. It's not like a huge operation with unpaid cooking school externs all over the place, and all you have to do is move them around and promote a few of the salad girls. It would be made a little easier, obviously, if I were just the male chef husband of a wife who is about to be having a baby, and not the actual female chef about to be having the actual baby, because he could just take a few days or a week off and then get back into the game. And it would be better still if I had one of those rock-solid marriages where both working parents living in the same harmonious home take on the responsibilities of parenting equally. But we were still living apart and parenting alone in a kind of pass-the-baton relay and thanking the stars for the full-time babysitter who was the true third parent in our little off-kilter arrangement. On Monday afternoon, possibly 3 days away from my due date, but none of us knowing for sure, as it was just an educated guess on the obstetrician's part, Annabelle, a skilled line cook with a good palate, arrived for work, late and breathless. I was at my cutting board at the downstairs prep table, making a family meal for the evening shift. I was so profoundly out of breath, with the baby's foot so far up into my guts that there was no room for my lungs to expand to full capacity, and I was winded just standing still. My apron string was tied up under my breast like an empire waistline, but I walked to the sink and back like a mailed and mounted soldier who has just had a long, tough match on the jousting field, and not like a maiden in the palace. I said, in 3 or 4 breaths, across the prep table where Annabelle had set up her board and put out her knives, "Hey, Annabelle, did you hear Connor's news?" And she said, across the prep table, as casually as we might say, "I'll blanch the beans, guys," she said, "Oh, yes. And I've got news, too." I looked up and stopped working on the birds I was deboning. I said, "You mean news, like you're giving notice news?" "Yep, that's what I mean," she said matter-of-factly. "Do you mean, like, giving notice as in 2 weeks' news right here across the prep table in front of everybody, like it's nothing?" I managed in a miraculous single breath. And she said, "Yes." The room came to a painful halt. I stood there with 2 other cooks and the pastry chef, and there was such a surge of stunned electricity in the room that the light bulbs practically flashed. Before I could stop myself, I burst out laughing and then said, as if it were just a mere fact, "You fucking suck so much." In the throbbing silence, I put down my knife and walked out. I went to my office and, with the door closed, stared futilely at the schedule. Then I called my obstetrician and scheduled my labor for Leone. He may have naturally been born on the 27th or the 25th or the 29th. I was healthy and there were no complications, and Dr. Kalish was going to give me 2 weeks on either side of the estimated due date for Leone's arrival. But I got so unraveled by the announcements of these 2 line cooks just days apart, coupled with so many other unknowns and things out of my control. Like, for example, how I would chef a jammed, brimming restaurant and take care of a 20-month-old and a nursing infant. that I felt in the moment like the only thing I could control was the birth of my second son. Okay, come in at 6 a.m. and we'll get you checked in and then we'll start to induce. I'll be there no later than 8:30. My obstetrician was matter of fact. I felt like I was placing my meat order with the butcher over the phone. I am often slow in catching up to the times, but even so, I still cannot even grip this idea. With nothing more than Pitocin in your IV drip, you can sooner control the date and time of the birth of a human being, the gushing entry into the great blue world of a whole new person, than you can the scheduling of a few line cooks in your operation. Leone Tommaso Fuertes would be born on April 24th, by appointment, like getting your hair cut or your dog groomed. I hung up the phone and sat at my desk a few seconds, staring at the schedule in front of me, realizing abruptly how passed over Annabelle felt when she didn't get promoted to Sue a few weeks before, and thinking about some of the tricks I have for these kinds of occasional, egregious cook shortages. I can limit the menu, run a two-person line, call in a freelance catering cook to punt for a week or two. I grabbed a black Sharpie and wrote myself a to-do list for all of it. In 20 years of chronic, compulsive list-making, I had authored some that had been downright Beckett-like in their sequencing. And it is exactly the anomaly in that sequencing, the non sequitur, that makes some of those to-do lists earn a spot in your box of keepsakes. One of my recent favorites had been Dr. Aioli, fine pH strips for dish machine, why is meringue weeping, braise rabbit, tell dad I'm pregnant, clean out shellfish tags, tweak gremolata ratio. But this one, written in a calm and steady hand, surpassed and out-surrealed all other to-do lists in my life thus far lived. Get with AT and limit menu, train CR on a two-man line, call Rody for fill-in, have baby, tell brunch crew vinaigrette too acidic, pick up white platters, change filters in hoods, figure out pomegranate syrup. And I did, in fact, do all of that. And the syrup got figured out, and the platters got picked up, and the hood filters got changed, and the baby was born, and the ship sailed, with a diminished crew and a severely handicapped captain. But most urgently, besides listing what to do and when to do it, alone in that office with the door closed, I sat trying to figure out how to leave my office and re-enter a room full of keenly watching cooks and get back to my cutting board and family meal without appearing devastated or even dented. The staff does not want to see you fall apart. It unnerves them. You can let it go in the privacy of your office. You can weep in the walk-in. But at the bench, you must pick up your knife and finish boning out those chickens. It's possible that working that brunch egg shift at 39 weeks pregnant is badass. And also possible that biting the bullet and scheduling your own labor is badass. Keeping your shit together in front of your crew, no matter what, is badass. Maybe even driving out to IKEA to pick up 30 white china platters and get back by dinner service the day before you're going to give birth is badass. But badass is the last thing I am interested in being. Badass is a juvenile aspiration. At 13, when I was stealing cars and smoking cigarettes, I wanted to be badass. I was cultivating badass. At 16, coked out of my head and slinging chili at the Lone Star Cafe, I was the understudy to Badass, and I knew all her lines and cues. At 25, blowtorching my way through warehouse catering kitchens, cranking out back-to-back doubles, and napping in between on the office floor with my head on a pile of aprons and checked pants, I was authentically Badass. But at 38 years old, hugely pregnant with my future, tiny, pure, precious son, I don't want anything to do with Badass. I want to be J. Crew catalog clean. I don't want to be that woman who can, and did, get down on all fours and scrape the pancake batter off the oven door after having just cooked 300 eggs with a near constant monologue of fucking fuck of a fuck issuing from her lips. That disgusts me. While I would never want or hope to be the type of pregnant woman who would doze languidly in the afternoons while playing Mozart tapes to her womb, being down on the mats with a soapy green scrubby and rattling my unborn fetus with a string of expletives to make a trucker blush, well, that is certainly not the woman I meant to grow up to be either. When you are the one throwing the party every night, emptying the ashtrays, making sure the tonic is cold, the limes fresh, the shifts covered, the meat perfectly cooked and adequately rested, the customers carefree, and the employees calm and confident. It will leave its marks. Someone has to stay in the kitchen and do the bones of the thing to make sure it stands up. And if it's you, so be it. Chapter 16. I was invited to be a panelist at a conference held at the prestigious Culinary Institute of America in Hyde Park, New York. The conference was called Where Are the Women? And the student chapter of Women Chefs and Restaurateurs had gathered a pretty decent roster of women chefs from around the country to come to the campus for the full day and evening and to participate in discussions, both formal and casual, with all the young women cooking students. Incredibly, it never goes away, this question about women. My relationship to women is exhaustively researched. I am one, for starters. Not quite as clean and polished as I'd like to be, but nonetheless, I'm a daughter and a daughter-in-law. I am a sister and have a sister. I've got a mother. There have been a lot of women in my life. I've had sex with them, I've hired them and fired them, worked side by side with them and under them. Several bosses come to mind. Women have brought me to the deepest, bitterest tears of my existence, and some, equally, have made me feel like brand new money. And not to rely on that old, tired credential, but some of my best friends are women. Still, what an impossible group to have to represent and presumably speak on behalf of. On the early morning train ride up, bleary-eyed, short on sleep by a critical several hours, I was thinking about what a particularly hard time I have had with women in my industry. When I was coming up in kitchens, I was not the first or only woman in the kitchen. I was frequently the second woman, the other woman. There is nothing worse, I think, than being in an all-male kitchen with only one other female. Invariably, with so much territory at stake, she will treat you worse than any of the men. When I am asked to wax rhapsodic about the virtues of women in a kitchen, I feel claustrophobic and hemmed in by the task. But that was so many years ago. Now, I imagined what a bust the conference would be. Letting my mind roll over my own payroll, female after female after female, from general manager to bar manager to sous chef to pastry chef to owner to server, I couldn't imagine that we were still having this conversation. This draining, polarizing conversation about where the women are in the industry. When I opened my own restaurant nearly 10 years ago, I finally put to bed that whole business about being a woman in a male-dominated profession. I was so obviously in charge that I didn't even need to say it. I unlocked the gate and the office in the morning and brewed the coffee. I wrote the menu, cut the checks, posted the prep list, cooked the food, and locked the door at the end of the night. Men who came to work at Prune understood at the threshold that there was a woman in charge, and all of them worked each shift, virility intact, without needing to challenge that. I received 5 resumes a week from young women entering the field, evidently not deterred by the reputation of the industry. Surely this stuff is over, I thought, finding my seat on the train. This topic's a dinosaur. Was it really necessary to get a chef who had worked late in her kitchen the night before out of her bed at such an hour in order to get to the upstate New York campus to talk about this all day long, starting at 9 a.m.? Chefs work late, and chef/owners work later. There's always more to do after the food is cooked. It was around 1:30 in the morning when I finally was in my pajamas and setting the alarm for 5. I had stopped nursing my youngest son only a few months before, so the idea and practice of getting very little sleep in increments was still completely routine. When I saw the alarm clock digitally glowing its 1:33 a.m. message as I was setting it to wake me up in just a few hours, I strategically coaxed my mind away from thinking ruefully about a pitiful night's sleep and redirected it to thinking deliciously about a long, full, luxurious nap. Somewhere between kid number 1 and kid number 2 and chef and owner and nursing and prepping and line cooking and workers' comp and commercial refrigeration, I learned to re-envision the amount of time I have available to sleep as an excellent nap instead of a paltry night's worth. In the morning, by the still weak light of day, I could not distinguish between the color of oatmeal and the color of yellow, it was still so dim. I dressed with the same grim determination as one about to take her vaccination shots. I packed a small bag, took deep, intoxicating lungfuls of my babies while lightly kissing them as they slept, and slipped out of the house into the dawn. The Peruvian panpipe player who sets up at my subway station was unbelievably lively and already hard at work, even that early in the morning. He's 5'2" and playful. He kind of darts and dances around the waiting passengers while he pipes along to the Titanic soundtrack and some Simon and Garfunkel tunes. Someone, I am sure, finds his qualities charming. I have murderous feelings about him and regularly fantasize his violent death on the tracks and imagine how much better off the world would be without him and his Peruvian pan-piping version of My Heart Will Go On. To be assaulted by this little nuisance 10 minutes after living through the agony, the unmitigated heartache of leaving my two guys in their beds asleep without one moment of being with them on this day, out before they wake and home well after they've gone to sleep, was more than I could take on less than 4 hours of sleep. When Mr. Panpipe segued into El Condor Pasa, I stood at the farthest end of the platform, cursing both him and these cooking school girls who could even think to drag me from my barely warmed-up bed, from my two boys with their soft, tubbied faces mushed up in perfect sleep, their diapered asses up in the air. Grand Central was fully alive with commuters clogging the escalators and shops and the concourses. I stood in a long but fast-moving line at a coffee place where the women in front and back of me ordered, with straight faces, drinks called double-skim half-decaf vanilla latte. And the young caffeinated baristas called these very same words back to the customer when putting up her drink without a single hint of scorn or derision in their voices, and I marveled, genuinely, at their generosity. I hate hating women, but double-skim half-decaf vanilla latte embarrasses me. I ordered a plain filtered coffee as if I were apologizing on behalf of my gender, and when I dug through my heavy purse to pay for it, I discovered in my bag a diaper, a resealable jar of apricot puree, and one of Marco's socks, which had somehow, in the general loss of boundary and private real estate that is motherhood, made its way in there. Once on the train, I sipped the coffee and read the prepared questions for the panel and the agenda for the day. I felt a small nervousness set in. What would I possibly have to say that could help these young women? I had never had a television show on the Food Network, had never hired a PR firm in my life. I had never chosen this career formally and had no experience climbing a ladder. I had just jumped into the fire and opened a restaurant of my own without ever having chefed in one. The questions all seemed largely aimed at discovering how to attain recognition for oneself. And on this particular morning, lovesick for my own children, terrifically backlogged on work at my own restaurant, I wondered uncomfortably why I was making the journey to Poughkeepsie just for that, just to end up carping bitchily at the girls about the most obvious of all obviousnesses. Put your head down and do your job and let the recognition end of things sort itself out. When I stepped onto the platform in Poughkeepsie, I was afraid of my own mood. I expected to fall into the company of my fellow female chefs and immediately, comfortably, be grousing with my sister panelists about these young, entitled students who know nothing of hard work and who just wanted to instantly have a cooking show on the Food Network so that they can be famous. I thought we women chefs would be allied against this obsession among the young with recognition and fame above merit and talent. I was not interested in answering this tired question, where are the women? Especially when we know perfectly well where the women are. They jumped to publishing and are now busy with idolizing the male chefs who made it impossible for them to continue cooking in restaurants, and they are so busy writing features and articles about them that they don't have time left, or column inches, for the female chefs who actually toughed it out. Women have self-selected out of the chef life, which can grind you to a powder, and have become happily married recipe testers and magazine editors, or private chefs, working moderate hours for good pay and benefits while successfully raising several small children whom they do not damage. I was sure my peers would feel equally disinclined. What was there left to say, really? Get in the kitchen, cook well, and the rest will take care of itself. You can't be a recognized woman chef if you are working at a magazine. My phone rang and it was Carlos, my sous chef, calling from the restaurant to check in. When I had left the night before, I wrote a long note for the day crew, but couldn't explain everything for a new dish we'd been running that nobody else had prepped but me. So he was calling for that most frustrating of experiences, the chef-by-phone tutorial. Hi, boss. Good morning. How's it going? We're fine. I'm going to start this rabbit project now. I think I've got it. I've read your notes. Yeah, I said. I'm sure you'll be fine. Just take care not to overbrown or to brown too fast the legs. You know how it really toughens the flesh as there's no skin, like on a piece of poultry or whatever. So, don't brown the rabbit? He asked. No, yes, brown the rabbit, yes. I'm just saying take care not to overbrown it or to use too high a heat. It can make the meat have a stringy, tough quality even after the braise. Okay, I got it, he said with a little unsettling tone that makes me, on the platform in Poughkeepsie, feel useless and not confident in Table 7's experience with the rabbit later this evening. Okay, and then Carlos? Yes, boss? It's not fatty, you know, and the bones are quite small. You can't just leave it to braise and forget about it. It can only braise about 25 minutes and then it's done. So when the joints are loose but not falling apart, it's finished. What joints? He asks. Now I'm pacing on the platform, dodging the few people who have exited the train and are filing toward the station. The joint between the thigh and the leg, it's got to have give and motion, but if it separates, you've gone too far. If it's too underdone, it won't recover in the pickup. It has to be braised properly in the prep, otherwise it's just hot but not adequately cooked through when they pick it up at service. As I'm trying to explain this, the platform has completely emptied, and I am the last one standing on it. A train employee with a rolling garbage can enters the empty train to collect discarded newspapers, coffee cups, and breakfast wrappers. Okay, boss, I got it. Have fun up there. See you tomorrow. I took a taxi from the train station to the campus and stood for a moment where the driver dumped me at the bottom of the circular drive. I felt like I was at an Ivy League college in New England that I would have been rejected from had I applied. There were big brick buildings and sweeping views of the surrounding valley. Students were flocking across campus in every direction, in a hurry, but instead of low-cut jeans and cashmere sweaters and backpacks, all were dressed in checks and whites and carrying their knife rolls. Ivy-covered brick buildings in which to learn the five mother sauces. In the lobby of the building, I met up with the other women chefs who were also just arriving, and Kat Cora came in behind me, looking so fresh and excited and pretty. I immediately got caught up in her good energy and natural kindness, and the dangerous mood that had started to take hold of me on the train quickly evaporated. I shook hands with the few panelists I had never met, and I warmly hugged the women I already knew. It's not that uncommon, after a very short while, to feel like you know all of the other women in your industry, as the pool gets small fast. If there's an event for women, we are all trotted out sooner or later, and we meet each other with some frequency. That should have made me think, then, while greeting my co-panelists, that maybe there was some validity to the conference after all. If there were so few of us visible in the industry that we kept seeing each other at so many events, there must still be a problem with employing female chefs. I suddenly recalled running into a male colleague on the street in New York one summer. He's not a chef, but he owns some restaurants and has an excellent female chef at the helm of his places. He was walking down the sunny street with his tall, elegant mother, who was visiting from San Diego. Hey, we exclaimed to each other. Hello there. He introduced me to his mother as one of the top, one of the best female chefs in New York City. I laughed. Well, there are only four of us in New York, so I don't know about that. We all laughed, and then, without even thinking about it, I said, now, if we could just get that word female out of the sentence. And suddenly, this dead cheerlessness came over the sidewalk, and all of us felt awkward, taking that moment to reimagine the same sentence without the qualifying word female. Mom, this is one of the top, one of the best chefs in New York. I wished I hadn't mentioned it. But on this morning in Hyde Park, I was fixed on dismissing the validity of the conference. Even though I can't understand for one second what the difference is between a male chef and a female chef, the food has to be cooked and we all just cook it. Even though I simultaneously soar and cringe to be called one of New York City's top female chefs, somehow I had set my mind to it that this conference would be a bust, even as I was palpably buoyed by the sudden shift in power, that infectious, energizing feeling while standing together in the reception hall with this bunch of smart, strong women. There was a brief, awkward moment in the coat check area where we were asked to don our chef coats for the rest of our time on campus, and I didn't want to. Whenever I see a chef outside of his kitchen in the civilian world, dressed in his whites, I think he looks like a dipshit with an insecurity issue. But the organizers wanted to make a statement with the visual cue of 10 women in starched monogram chef coats walking from building to building, from lecture to cocktail reception, to dinner to evening panel in the auditorium. I couldn't decide if I wanted to emphasize my femaleness or my chefness. If I were emphasizing my chefness, I would have worn the jacket. But if I was emphasizing my femaleness and my confidence in my equal abilities and talents, I wouldn't want to wear the jacket. I would want to say, sartorially, that I am so confident and secure in my role that I don't need the costume to prop me up. At every single event with women chefs that I participate in, I can see the women struggling, on some level, with this very basic question of what to wear. The woman in shiny pink patent leather clogs has decided one thing. The woman in a black shirt and apron but no jacket has decided another. The woman who dresses exactly like Thomas Keller has decided yet another. Even this question of dressing for your work is exhausting. Would a guy have gone through this kind of soul searching? I think he would have just worn the coat. He may even have arrived wearing it. If there'd been a toque requested, he probably would have thrown that on too, without hesitation. When we got to the auditorium, it was packed to the gills and humming with the excitement of hundreds of young women. They were sitting in every seat and spilling into the aisles. We took our seats at the table on stage facing them, and I felt nervous and looked down at my own stomach and noticed that in the dim light of early morning, I had not seen the dried, crusty oatmeal on my yellow sweater that Marco must have rubbed there with his little fingers some or other morning ago. For some reason, I worry terribly about appearing dirty and ill put together. In the same way that I don't want to be taken care of in a hospital by a pale, chain-smoking doctor, I feel like the people who prepare your food should look healthy and robust and tidy. I scraped at the oatmeal with my fingernail and pushed my open handbag farther under the table so no one would see the sock and the diaper and the apricot puree tucked in with the wallet and the keys and the travel toothbrush. There were a bunch of young men in the audience as well. We were introduced by the moderator, and I thought our chiding would start right then and there about how you should put your head down and do your job and stop worrying about fame and fortune. But the first question came to the panel from a young woman high up in the balcony on the right, and my heart broke in the first 5 seconds. She stood up, and in a thin voice that she managed to project all the way down to the stage, she asked her pressing question, "Is it okay to cry?" I do almost $2 million a year in sales. I know that this is nothing compared to my colleagues who have 100-seat restaurants and 4 branches, but for an independent 30-seat joint with no single wine over $89, I am very proud of this volume. We have never accomplished the standard industry ideal of 10% profit, but I love the revenue number nonetheless. I think it's an accomplishment. More important, I decide who our purveyors are, what sodas and beers we carry, what linen service we use, what garbage removal service we use, the glassware, tableware, the wine and liquor, the cheese, the meat, the vegetables. I mention this only because if I'm going to spend $100,000 a year on produce, or linen, or printing, you can't send a sales rep who calls me hun. You can't be a potential produce vendor seeking my business by addressing your query letter, "Dear Sir." I will drop that purveyor's list in the trash can unread, right on top of my bloody tampon, as soon as I see that out-of-date salutation at the top of the page. But I won't cry. Equally, someone seeking employment can't fax in a resume to "Sir," because I won't hire him if that is his default point of view. I won't cry, I just won't hire him. You don't have to fight or argue or bitch or cry at all. I just quietly spend my money with another company that I perceive has caught up to the times, and I hire people I can enjoy working with. This genuine power makes you gentle. Many of the students were concerned about the constant negotiating one does, internally and externally, to get by in the male kitchen, and asked the panel how to navigate that. Melissa said she used to just do her work and quietly shine. But Helene said, "No way." I roared through the kitchen. I bested the men at every turn. When I got promoted and they didn't, I turned around sweetly and said, "Bye, guys." I had tried smoking filterless cigarettes, swearing like a sailor, pissing in bottles, and banging out twice as much as my male cohorts. And I'd also given lipstick and giggling a try, even claiming to not be able to lift a stock pot so that the guys would help me. Neither strategy is better than the other. It was not until I opened my own place that I realized how present and ongoing the struggle to be female in a professional kitchen had been. It's like the hood during service. Everybody talks about the heat in a kitchen, and the heat, without doubt, is formidable. It's a powerful opponent. But for me, the real punisher is the exhaust hood, with the suction so powerful that it sucks up all the metal-bound filters from their spots and bangs them against the lip of the hood. The big mechanic kick of the fan belt starting up, the unified clank of the filters rising, like a rocket's kick, all in unison. Then followed by 18 draining hours of heavy-duty vacuum hum, over which orders are barked, dishes are clanked, pots are slammed around, and the stereo blasts. Then finally at midnight, or one, after the disher has turned off the fryer, someone turns off the hood, and a profound silence descends. I never realize how much space the noise of the hood takes up in my mind and head, that heavy vacuum sound, until I shut it off, and total bliss and relief set in. In the same way, when I opened my own restaurant, I enjoyed such an absence of boy-girl jostling that I only then understood that, all through my entire work life, I had been working a double shift. I had been working the same shift as my peers, with all of its heat and heft and long hours on your feet, but I had been doing a second job all along as well, that of constantly, vigilantly figuring out and calibrating my place in that kitchen with those guys to make a space for myself that was bearable and viable. Should I wear pink clogs or black steel-toe work shoes? Lipstick or chapstick? Work double hard, double fast, double strong? Or keep pace with the average Joe? Swear like a line cook or giggle like a girl? Meanwhile, the parsley needs to be chopped and the veal chops seared off. There is, still, the work itself to do. Someone on the panel to my right said, out loud into the microphone, "Women are more clever than men." And then, as if inspired, the woman to my left said, "Women are smarter than men." I was feeling hot and insecure about the oatmeal on my sweater to begin with, and was still reeling and deep in thought about the crying question. So I had said only a few words so far into the microphone, and I felt like while I had withdrawn for those few minutes, this group of women, my sister panelists, had set up camp and staked out the territory in a very different place than I wanted to be. This was not double skim, half decaf vanilla latte embarrassing, but a different kind of bothersome. Anne said, "Women don't like to come out from behind the stove and be a presence on the floor of their restaurants." Helene said, "Women have better palates than men." Odessa said, "Women are more nurturing than men." Nora said, "Women are not competitive. They shy away from the limelight." I slumped in my chair, dying. We attract and hire a lot of female cooks at Prune because word got out in the industry that if you wanted a nice place to work without the feel of hostile male colleagues, you should come here. Prune likes women. That is not technically true. We like anybody who gets the job done, and that happens to be the profile of many hardworking and qualified women who have passed through my kitchen over the years. And it is sure that if you work at Prune, you will be handling the meat and the fish as much as the guy next to you. You will not be shoved into the pastry or the salad station in perpetuity. And you will probably enjoy the way that being in the company of many women renders your own femaleness almost inconsequential, such a non-issue that it is never a distraction from the work itself. But I could never truthfully or proudly utter the sentences these women were letting fly out of their mouths. If anything, I have come to love the men who also feel that the kitchen is a better place when women are allowed to work in it. The men who feel that if any part of society is abused, that it demeans the rest of the society. Those are the men and women I want to spend 18 hours a day with over a hot stove, under a relentless humming hood. Identity politics never ends up going the distance for me. The categories tend to fall apart on me when I rely on them too heavily. Gay people, women, whatever. Every time I think I can rely on a group or a category, like my sister women in the industry, or my sister lesbians or whatever, Ruth Reichel frosts me at an event for the seventh time, or the women on my panel say ridiculous things about women's superiority, or the lesbians go out and start voting Republican, and the whole thing caves in for me, and I start to mistrust my own kind. Especially when they start saying things like, women are better than men. I had really checked out of the panel. I was so caught up in a livid confusion deep in my own mind that I wasn't even listening to the panel anymore. I get adrenaline rushes sometimes that are so thick I feel as if I've blacked out. When I could hear again, I heard a young woman ask, how do you manage family and career? I want to get married and have kids, but I am afraid I won't be hired as a chef if I say that to an employer. And I'm worried I won't even have a boyfriend anymore if I have to work the hours I've heard about. To her question, my sister panelists gave peppy, cheerful, you can do it kind of crap answers, completely generic, unspecific answers. And before I knew it, I had reversed my own allegiances and was now in love with all of the CIA students and totally dismayed by almost half of my peers on the panel. I wanted to hang out with the students and gripe about women panelists. I now wanted to answer all of their good, valid questions, and I suddenly felt that the conference was highly pertinent and overdue. I really started itching when this 60-year-old woman droned on into the mic to her 20-year-old audience about the joys of building relationships with local, sustainable farmers, as if these young cooks were about to enter jobs that would put them anywhere near to the sourcing of the restaurant's ingredients. I was thinking about the pleasure, the sheer pleasure of killing the line on a busy night, setting those tickets up and knocking them down, of the knives laid out neatly on the magnet, the worn wooden cutting boards, the feel of the cool silky flour every time you dip in with the measuring cup, of sitting down with everybody after work and drinking cocktails, telling grossly distorted tales of your own heroics on the line that night. I felt I had to testify to this pleasure, to speak about the total satisfaction of killing the line. The way scrubbing down your station afterward puts your mind right. About the third shift, the drinks after work. I wanted to say that we are all not sitting around in our naturally woven fibers, eating our organic quinoa salads, and thinking up our next sustainable charity project. Some of us are actually cooking and enjoying cooking. But I had shut down and couldn't muster for this part of the panel, where my supposed peers were gassing on about themselves, giving these young women the impression that each day in a kitchen is like going to some priggish church. They were speaking as women who were 30 years into an industry, and the young women we were meant to address had yet to experience even their first day of it. Why didn't a single one of us mention cooking? Why didn't we say, if you want your cooking career to be recognized, be a good cook? Cook, ladies, cook. Defeated, I thought about what I had had to do to arrange getting to the conference that day in the first place. If I had just told them about that small journey, from my apartment with two sleeping children to their campus, as the chef and owner of a restaurant and the mother of two little kids, wouldn't just that answer all of their questions about family and career and motherhood? If I told them about the panpipe player and the full day in which I would never see my boys awake, if I told them how I joke that I now pity the women who start families who have not been chefs, how I wonder earnestly, how does the office worker woman who is so accustomed to her 40-hour work week, her daily lunch hour, her inbox and her outbox, handle all the pain and the physical contortions and the mayhem of suckling, crying, ear infections, and working if she has never had to skin a live eel, placate the angry patron at table 7 who finds his rabbit a bit stringy, and carry an epileptic line cook off the mats who has suffered a grand mal seizure during service? How will the woman who is accustomed to great personal and bodily integrity suffer the cannibalizing feeling that nursing constantly can leave you with, as if you were being eaten alive, not in huge monster gore chunks, but like a legion of soft, benign caterpillars makes lace of a leaf? I thought of telling them how changing a diaper reminds me every time of trussing a chicken. How sleepless nights and long, grueling hours under intense physical discomfort were already part of my daily routine long before I had children. How labeling every school lunch bag, granola bar, juice box, extra sweater, and nap blanket with permanent Sharpie is like what we've been doing every day for 30 years, labeling the foods in our walk-ins. How being the chef and owner of a restaurant means you have already, by definition, mastered the idea of systems, routines, and protocols, so that everyone who works for you can work smart hard rather than work stupid hard. so that by the time you are setting up your household and preparing yourself for adding children, you have a tendency toward this kind of order, logic, and efficiency. Multitasking, answering questions on the phone, cooking something, and trying to monitor a line cook while hearing your name repeated possibly 600 or 700 times in less than 8 hours, is exactly like trying to run a family and a business. A choking patron, a grease fire, a badly cut employee. Once you have been through that, figuring out how you will get your injured child to the emergency room of a hospital in the nearest Italian town where you are alone on vacation should come a little easier to you. Not to give the impression that if you've been a chef, then adding parenthood to your day is just as easy as running a lamb shank special on your menu. Days go very badly, and there is never balance. Everybody gets shorted, everybody gets hurt, and you, the mom, not the least. But it does give you a leg up, I often think, because the restaurant family is a perfect starter family. It's such an accurate in-flight simulator that I have grown to feel sorry for anybody who enters parenthood and a domestic project without having first run a restaurant. From the earliest stages of family life when you are pregnant and uncomfortable and not sleeping well at night, the parallels to running a restaurant are almost over-obvious, and all of that work you've done on your feet all day, with back problems from lifting so much heavy stuff or standing in one place for so long, with sometimes no time to eat or even to pee, and not sleeping much at all because of your commitment to your restaurant, will all feel incredibly familiar and doable. And then when the suckling critter arrives, you will just fold that into your day like you have all the other leaking, sticky, oozy fluids you've been handling for the past decade. Every time you have to change the diaper of a non-compliant kid, you will be reminded of every chicken you've ever trussed and every eel you've ever had to wrangle. Petulant adolescents who just want to borrow money, raid the fridge, and talk on the phone with their friends about what a bitch you are? That will be a piece of cake once you have managed a front-of-house staff, denied the bartender her vacation request, and uneasily loaned the new line cook her first and last month's rent deposit on her new West Village apartment, knowing well you will never see that money again. I wanted to interrupt my fellow panelists now going on about how women cook better than men and how they're faster and cleaner and smarter, and just tell this story to the young woman in the 15th row. But their essentialist drone drove me to silence, and I saved my tears for the train ride home. Butter. Chapter 17. Carmelucci came one afternoon to pay a visit. We had arrived in Leuca just a few days before, Michele and I and our two kids, the new one, Leone, while only a couple of months old, lavishly adored. We were just settling in, like butter on toast, to our annual July vacation. I unpacked our suitcases and stored them under the antique iron bed. Michele walked into town to get Il Giornale and I Cornetti. Carmelucci arrived with 8 of her own eggs, biscotti she had made, a little hooded bath towel for Leone, and about 1 kilo of homemade orecchiette, little ears, and minchieredi, little penises, still damp and warm from her hands. Carmelucci, in Michele's family's history of help, came before Rosaria and after Pasqualina. There has always been the woman. The woman who comes each day and helps with the cooking and the cleaning and the ironing. I have known only Rosaria in the years that I've been coming here, but I met Pasqualina, now in her 70s, one year when Michele took us all to pay a visit. She was, even in the depth of summer, all in widow's black with heavy stockings and a woolen cardigan, and she showed us a couple of her own rabbits in her freezer, killed and skinned with her own hands. I vowed to start my long, arduous application for Italian citizenship by marriage as soon as I got back to the States when I saw those rabbits. In my vision of my own old age, I too want to be shelling fava beans and skinning rabbits and having the people I have cared for stop by for a glass of cold tea. I want to grow old in Italy. Carmelucci, in her 60s now, the woman between Pasqualina and Rosaria, arrived to pay us a visit in the late afternoon. She is stout and red in the face, with good, meaty hands and round hips and ankles so sturdy that they looked kind of wrong in the dressy-heeled shoe that she was wearing. She was in a clean, simple dress without earrings or makeup, and wore only a gold chain that had a cross and a saint's medallion, and her wedding band. There was much kissing and hugging when she arrived, and great coochie-cooing with Leone, and an extravagant display of amazement at how big Marco had grown since we were here last year. Every single Italian woman I have ever met is perfect with children, and Carmelucia is more perfect than them all. We all sat in the parlor on the good chairs, kind of pleasantly staring at each other. Michele disappeared to the kitchen to spoon out pink and white ice cream into four glass bowls, place them on a tray with the real silver spoons, and as if he were again the 13-year-old boy in short pants that Carmelucia cleaned up after, who was forced to comb his hair and kiss the ladies' hands and to serve the visiting guests, he came around to each of us and politely served us the ice cream from a tray. And there we sat, three women accustomed to work from the moment we wake until the moment we lay down our heads, not quite seamlessly transformed into gentle ladies by a tray, a cushioned chair, and the polite sharing of a hot afternoon's bowl of ice cream with silver spoons. Marco splashed around on the terrace in his little blow-up swimming pool. Leone snoozed in the linen basket, and Alda and I sat with Carmelucia, and they made conversation while I just listened and tried to decipher the Italian. I couldn't understand but a few words of it, and I wondered if they were speaking to each other in local dialect, but even so, or especially so without language, I could see that we were all kind of stiff and uncomfortable, with not that much to say once children and various family members had been asked about. During a pretty significant lull, I admired Carmelucia's orecchiette and asked her a few questions about how she made them while we finished up the last bites of our ice cream. "Do you want me to show you? I can show you. It's nothing. Signora, flour and water. Come, let me show you." And within a few minutes, we have escaped the parlor and are all back in the kitchen where we are all most comfortable, rolling up our sleeves, forming a little circle around her while she prepares to make pasta at the kitchen table. "Donna Alda," she said, "where are you keeping your flour now? Where is the flour? We need the durum flour, only the durum flour." I smiled to think that she believed it possible that the location of the flour could possibly have changed since she was with the family. The flour, as it had been for decades, was kept in the cabinet, and I retrieved it for her. Without even removing her wedding band, she dumped a small pile of the flour directly onto the table, made a well in the center, and added water. There was nothing to measure. She began to knead the dough as familiarly as you or I might pet the family dog. The dough stuck to her fingers at first, and she scraped it off and worked it back into the greater mass of dough. Alda found an apron, and from behind, like a tailor draping a client for a custom suit, tied it around Carmelucia's waist, barely disrupting the kneading. I don't know what they are saying, but conversation has really picked up, and now Rosaria is with us, holding baby Leone and offering advice on texture and humidity of dough, and Alda, of course, has her own advice and opinions. Even Michele, who is so far removed from the time when he made pasta like an Italian, the 52-year-old doctor who's lived in America for the past nearly 30 years and who now shops exclusively and with great American enthusiasm for discounts and bargains at Home Depot, The Gap, and Costco, even he wants to weigh in. Through the great din of opinions, without oil or salt or eggs, Carmelucia produces a soft, pliable, elastic dough. It is simply flour and water. I have never been able to identify or understand my class. I think we were raised as bourgeoisie, but I am not even sure what the term means. Shop owners? And I remember it being spit out in the most derogatory way in the books that I loved most when I was in college. I think it's considered loathsome. I'm comfortable upstairs and downstairs. I do low-paying manual labor and always have, but I'm educated and came to own my own business when I was 34 years old. We owned our house growing up, but tenuously. So tenuously that we jokingly referred to the bank man who carried my father through a lot of dark valleys as Uncle Bill. But we traveled in the summers and drank champagne at holidays. I know which fork to use with which course because I have set and cleared so many tables, not because I have sat at so many. I employ a full-time babysitter in New York, but I'm so awkward about it, it's so new for me, that I get the skillet onto the stovetop and cook the chicken nuggets and finish all the dinner dishes and clean out the bathtub of tubby toys and soap scum and sweep the floors so that she can spend the day watching cartoons with the kids. I have even done all of those things one-handed while using my other hand to hold my nursing infant like a football. Cooking dinner, sweeping the floor, and nursing an infant simultaneously? I have done it. A lot. So that when the babysitter arrives, I have erased any inconvenience for the woman because I'm so uncomfortable with the whole scenario. Americans are raised to be uncomfortable with the scenario, and we do it all wrong. We confuse the whole thing with class and status and money, and we pay shitty wages under the table without insurance or job security, and way too frequently with disrespect for the people who do this work. Or we go the opposite direction and act our noblesse oblige, and when we empty our closets, we offer our hand-me-downs, and we inquire after the health and well-being of the nanny's own children, who are usually back in Honduras and being raised by their grandmothers. We did not have help in our house growing up. My mother cooked and cleaned and kept the house with five children by herself. There was June, a seamstress, who mended all of our clothes and shortened and lengthened the hems on all the hand-me-downs as they were handed down among the five children. And there was an occasional babysitter I remember, an Italian-American woman, Alice Narducci, and sometimes I was dropped at her house. She ate dinner from a tray in the living room watching the Lawrence Welk show, and she let me have red gelatin with whipped cream for dessert, both after lunch and after dinner, two desserts in the same day. The new status of the chef as celebrity further confuses me. I used to be the help, arriving by the back service elevator, respecting your wishes for well-done beef, dressing on the side, one cube only in your glass of Smirnoff. When I finished cooking and cleaning up, I swept and mopped the floors, put two dish towels under my shoes, and skated, printless, to the back door. I called the service elevator and exited your building through the basement warren of hallways with dumpsters, never having been seen by you or your guests. Now, the Food and Wine Festival organizers arrange my airfare, install me in suites on high floors of exquisite hotels I could never afford on my own income. And you eat my food as I've envisioned it and prepared it, as heavily sauced, salted, or rare, as I like. Once in South Beach, at the Food and Wine Festival, we were picked up at the hotel and driven to the venue in a black Cadillac Escalade with black tinted windows, the driver in a crisp suit with oiled hair, gold rings, a fresh stick of gum in his mouth. I felt giddy with transgression. We rode a full 2 feet taller than anyone around us, like military brass. I was giggling, tapping my clogs on the floor, turning around in my seat to share conspiratorial tee-hees with my sous chef. At a red light, a ruined guy in a wheelchair with his legs sawed off rolled up to the gleaming black machine and begged at my black, expressionless window. I quickly imagined myself as a bystander on the sidewalk, watching the electric window whisper down, a disembodied white hand spit out a few bills, and retreat as the tinted glass rose up and resealed the fortress. Then I imagined the opposite scenario, the one in which the guy in the wheelchair faces the impenetrable black window of the towering SUV, and nothing happens. He is simply ignored, facing his own widened reflection in the high gleam. Paralyzed by the hideousness of both scenarios, I turn to Carlos and say, "Well, I feel really good about myself right now. But in Italy, I can't understand anyone's class, let alone my own. The woman comes for a few hours each day in the mornings and helps with laundry and ironing and cooking and cleaning. She owns her own house. Her husband runs his own business. This only describes the summertime vacation help. But when the Fortes kids were young and their father was still alive, during the school years in the city, there were two full-time live-ins plus a third part-timer who came in the mornings to keep the family machinery running." There's something that feels so uncomplicated and without subjugation about it, even though I see perfectly well that Alda is the one with the heavy sack of keys. Not one of us seems to prefer sitting down in the parlor being served ice cream. Alda's tone when speaking to these women sounds, to my ear, totally equal and not for a moment proprietary. There seems to be absolutely no money at all and nothing coming in, really, from all the land they own, and most of the house seems to be in serious disrepair. But there is no confusing this. They call Alda, Donna Alda, they call me, Signora, they call Michele, Dottore, and when the sun finally sets over the impluvium, we sleep in the big villa on the big street called Via Tommaso Fortes. Leone's full name, to be clear, is Leone Tommaso Fortes. He is 3 months old and already has international travel stamped into his passport. He has a passport. He will grow up to inherit this house with Marco, or what's left of it by then. This is so far removed from my own experience that I am made breathless by it. Carmelucci rolls out a small rope of pasta dough and then cuts little pellets about the length and diameter of a squeeze of toothpaste. From these, she makes the arrechete by smudging them with her thumb until they look like little flat coins on the table, which she picks up, turns inside out to become concave, and sets to dry on a tray. They look exactly like small, delicate ears. The little penises she makes by pressing a common knitting needle down into the pellet and using it like a rolling pin until the dough has closed into a tube around the needle. Americans would never recognize the shape as a penis because of our obsession with circumcision, but anyone familiar with the unmaimed ones in their unaroused state will see it in an instant.